You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, some stores are staying closed on the Thanksgiving holiday instead of opening up at night for early Black Friday shopping. We'll find out what you think about the holiday shopping scene.
First, the election of Donald Trump to the nation's highest office has many analysts and citizens trying to figure out what kind of president he'll be on a certain issue or how he'll treat certain groups of people, including the Black Lives Matter movement.
What started as a small protest in 2013 after George Zimmerman's acquittal for the shooting death of Trayvon Martin, it's steadily been building steam across the country in recent years as more high-profile cases of violence against African Americans have been made public. But with the election of Donald Trump, who once suggested that a Black Lives Matter protester should have been roughed up at one of his rallies, there are questions about the movement's future, where they go from here, and the fear of retaliation from the nation's highest office.
Chad Dion Lassiter joins us now to break down some of these questions. He's president of Black Men at Penn and a professor of race at the University of Pennsylvania. Chad, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
So first off, what kind of impact do you think the election of Donald Trump will have on the Black Lives Matter movement in America?
I think it's going to have a very divisive impact because of the racial rhetoric that then-candidate Donald Trump was displaying with. And a leopard doesn't change his spots overnight. And so some of the xenophobic, some of the homophobic, some of the white supremacist ideology that he spewed as running for a candidate, I don't think that just changes because he becomes a president-elect. I think we're going to see some challenges even more so as it relates to the stop-and-frisk policies and several other policies.
Looking at what we have seen so far in some places, no means by all places, but some hate crimes reported in the country, do you read anything into that or do you say this is a time of transition?
No, it's beyond a time of transition. This is a very dark period in our democracy. The Southern Law Poverty Center reported 200-plus incidents with regards to hate crimes, anti-Semitism, with regards to what's happening with Islamophobia. And so this is not a transition time. This is a very dark time. And the election of Donald Trump is not just inclusive to the Black Lives Matter movement, because we've seen people all over the United States of America march in protest to him being the president-elect.
Do you think that means that the Black Lives Matter movement now has maybe more allies than it did earlier?
It could have the potential of having allies. As a social scientist, I'm not so certain that they didn't have allies before, because the media elites tried to divide the country. And so we know that a lot of marches around the country with regards to Black Lives Matter have had white allies and Asian allies. We know that as far as away as China and Japan, there are people who are holding signs Black Lives Matter. I think what we need to continue to do is show the benefits of everyone seeing everyone's humanity, but specifically in this period of time, Black lives certainly do matter.
I think you just used the phrase media elites, if I heard you correctly. I wonder if you could talk a little more about what you mean by that, about, I believe you said, try to divide or make the movement look more divided than it was. Explain, if you would, what you mean by that.
Well, what I mean by the media elites is that the media constructs the context. They write the script, they write the narrative, they keep the country divided, race sells, violence sells. So one would think that there are not white people who are protesting Black Lives Matter as well. You would think that, you know, it's just African Americans. You have whites who are wearing shirts that say Black Lives Matter. I'm a professor at Westchester University. I teach race relation courses for social work students, and the majority of my students are white. And they are deeply concerned about the anthology of police brutality. You have students who are walking out who are white students in places like Seattle, at Cal Berkeley. And so the media elites want us to think that there's more division than there's more unity. And so with everything that's going on with Donald Trump, humanity of all colors are saying we're going to speak back to, you know, some of this rhetoric, some of this racially tinged comments that he's made. And that's what I mean by the media elites. They profit off of humanity not coming together as a human race. And so, yes, we have black, we have white, we have Latino, we have Asian American, Pacific Islander. At the end of the day, we're all humans.
Talking about using a critique of the media, using the phrase media elites, has been something that the Trump campaign has also been known for. So is that something that Black Lives Matter movement has common ground with, is do you think there does need to be some sort of critical overhaul of the press and the way it functions?
I think, yes, it does need to be an overhaul of the press. I think that when President-elect Trump was running, you had Fox News that was supporting him, but then you had MSNBC and CNN providing strong critiques and condemnation. Much of it was warranted because of some of the things that he actually was spewing out. But then you had Fox News who were really castigating and really critiquing Hillary Clinton, but then at times CNN and MSNBC did not hold her with the same critique. I think it's the same thing that we see with Black Lives Matter. If you look at Fox News, you would think that Black Lives Matter is a radical group. Black Lives Matter is not a radical group. Looking at things historically, the Black Panthers celebrating their 50th year anniversary this year was not a black radical group. It was a group that was organized in defense of white supremacy. And certainly we don't want police officers being killed in our democracy, but those individuals that are killing them are not members of Black Lives Matter. Those are individuals who have joined Black Lives Matter because they have some sort of angst, so they show up at the rallies. One of the things we do know is that the Ku Klux Klan is real in the United States. The Ku Klux Klan oftentimes hide behind their sheets, but during the day, we know the data speaks to some of them are our doctors, our lawyers, some of them are our judges, some of them are our police officers.
We're talking right now with Chad Dion Lassiter. He's president of Black Men at Penn and a professor of race at the University of Pennsylvania, talking about the future of the Black Lives Matter movement in an era of a Trump presidency. And Chad, one of the founders of Black Lives Matter, Patrice Cullors, wrote an opinion piece in The Guardian last week, and in it, she calls on Black Lives Matter supporters to organize, and she says, and this is a quote, "It's time to start building real political power." What might that power look like?
I don't know the Black Lives Matter agenda as it relates to that. For me, it looks like joining local elections, and it means joining potential national elections, federal elections as well. It means sitting within the seats of power, maybe in the head of a nonprofit, as Trump talks about getting rid of Medicaid and Medicare, rolling back the clock on parent planninghood and things of that nature. I would like to see members of Black Lives Matter be part of legislation, be part of policy, be part of crafting policy that's going to not just advantage African Americans, but going to advantage people who are disenfranchised. There are a lot of whites who are disenfranchised as well, even though the data speaks to a lot of them voted against their entrance to maintain the status quo of white supremacy and white male dominance in the person of Donald Trump. And so I see that as something where crafting a political agenda puts them in a place where they can look at things from a policy perspective and they can actually enact policy. So when we have stop and frisk, we need to have community policing. Where we have racism and spatial segregation in housing, we can have people who are in those agencies that can speak back to those forms of discrimination, so forth and so on, is the way that I see it developing.
Do you see any comparison to the Tea Party, which it started as a protest movement and then it became this full-scale political movement putting up political candidates? Do you see the Black Lives Matter movement moving maybe in that direction?
I'm not certain if it's going to move in that direction. I don't see similarities. Being from Philadelphia and traveling the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, I went to a lot of the Tea Party rallies in Ohio, Indiana, as well as in parts of eastern and western Pennsylvania. And what you saw with the Tea Party was just this aspect of let's take our country back, this aspect of American exceptionalism, this aspect of scapegoat hypothesis. The reason why we're out of our job is because of those blacks or because of those Mexicans. The Black Lives Matter was speaking back to the suffering of the anthology of police brutality. If there was a similarity, it's both the Tea Party and the Black Lives Matter are using agency, which is voice, to speak back to the way they may have viewed their oppression and their marginalization. Tea Party rallies, to me, have been, really, really violent, the ones that I've gone to, not towards me, but the rhetoric has been violent. People have carried weapons, guns, open carry. At Black Lives Matter, I've seen humanity come together, and they have said, let's speak back to what's going on. Let's hold the state accountable. It was created in defense of blacks being killed by the state with impunity.
Now, Donald Trump's victory was described as a white lash by CNN analyst Van Jones. This is the idea that whites in America were pushing back against a changing country. And going forward, What would your advice be to white allies who support the Black Lives Matter movement?
I would say just to stay the course. Van Jones is absolutely right. It was about the white male dominance being threatened, the ever-changing demographics in our democracy, and it was the last fight for white male dominance, white supremacy, and white privilege. For our white colleagues, no one is saying that you should give up your privilege. Use your privilege, leverage your privilege to help those, like those in the Black Lives Matter movement, those who are being discriminated against because of transphobia, homophobia, xenophobia, Islamophobia. I would tell them to stay dedicated, stay focused. Don't let the media elites, don't let anyone divide them, that the mission of just highlighting Black humanity and that Black humanity is worth saving, similar to what Martin Luther King did along with his Jewish and white colleagues, it's really essential. So that would be my message to white allies who want to figure out how we can make the society more tolerant for all, but specifically because of the killing of Black lives with impunity by the state.
There's been a lot of talk, especially this week, about Donald Trump's cabinet appointments. Some people concerned with the appointment of Steve Bannon from Breitbart, saying some people saying this puts a white supremacist in the White House, other people taking a different point of view. But what do you say about that and what it could mean?
I think that we should be really concerned with everything that Donald Trump does. The assertion that he's part of the alt-right, the assertion that he's a white supremacist against the counter-narrative that he's not, he's just a white supremacist sympathizer, empathizer, I think we should be very concerned. We're heading into a dark time in our democracy. When we have a person like Hillary Clinton who has 30 years of experience, who's astute, who's a policy wonk, no matter our criticisms, we didn't vote for her. We voted for a reality television star who's a cult figure who said any and everything to get elected. And then he looks into the camera on 60 Minutes with regards to white supremacist behavior in the country, and he says, stop it. It needs to be more of an analysis other than just, you know, a proclamation of stop it. You know, it needs to be a clarion call to develop an office around anti-racism in the United States. And so I'm very concerned about that appointment. I'm concerned about the potential of an emerging appointment for Giuliani, no matter if it's Secretary of State and or Attorney General. It's really a challenging time, and we're suffering right now from a post-election stress disorder.
You said several times that we're heading into a dark time, that this is not an ordinary transition. So as president of Black Men at Penn, as someone who looks at Black Lives Matter, how should that dark time be answered?
Well, for me, it's just continue to stay ever vigilant on attempting to uproot American racism, dismantle American racism, building allies on every side of the color line, training my students to be tolerant, to not look at the racism that happens in America per se, but to be both and look at the racism that they sometimes display with, to work with my African-American colleagues to recognize that they can't buy into their own victimization, that institutional racism does exist. It's prejudice plus power, but at the end of the day, we have to be able to not move beyond it, but to be able to address it and to prove ourselves to be resilient and to be tolerant. And so for me, it's a lot of self-introspection. But with regards to Black Lives Matter, I think that that's one organization. There are multiple organizations that we can build coalitions with. The ACLU, some of our Jewish colleagues are willing to say, let's speak back to all the isms that happen, because even though Black people are being killed with impunity by the state, there's also anti-Semitism that goes unchecked in our democracy as well. And so when I mean that it's a dark time because we continue to sweep a lot of these isms under the rug, and Donald Trump has brought out that dark side. He didn't create it, but he stoked the flames.
Chad, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Chad Dion Lassiter, president of Black Men at Penn and a professor of race at the University of Pennsylvania. He joined us to talk about the future of the Black Lives Matter movement under a Trump administration. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, one hunter wonders if new regulations will change the hunting experience here in Wisconsin and take away some of the feeling of camaraderie.
First, as we head into next week's Thanksgiving holiday, the shopping scene may look a little different.
This year, some big names in retail are pushing back against the tendency to open earlier and earlier, with Black Friday carrying over into the Thanksgiving holiday. That's not completely a thing of the past. Some employees said they wanted the whole day with their families. Others liked getting overtime holiday pay.
This year, though, the Mall of America has announced it will be closed on Thanksgiving, along with some big heavy hitters in the retail industry: Apple, Barnes & Noble, Nordstrom, and TJ Maxx.
We want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. Do you go? Have you gone shopping on Thanksgiving Day, Thanksgiving night itself? Are you a Black Friday fan, but you can wait until the Friday? Or do you avoid the whole thing altogether? If you work retail or have worked retail, or maybe you own a local store, what do you think about the debate, opening or closing on Thanksgiving Day? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll take a caller now. We've got Dayton with us in La Crosse. Dayton, hi.
Hi. I have worked retail and customer service jobs for almost all of my career. I'm in my mid-20s right now. I've just been kind of saddened with how they keep on pushing the envelope on going further and further into Thanksgiving and taking time away from families. And I've also just been kind of perplexed by how Thanksgiving just kind of gets swept under the rug while people put out Christmas decorations and start playing Christmas music right away. So,
right. Some good points. So you're on the side of the Mall of America and Apple and that group, who are saying, you know, we're going to draw the line in the sand here and not go any further back into the Thanksgiving holiday.
Yeah, I think it's just it's an important holiday to just kind of reflect on, the things that you're thankful for. I specifically, I'm a Christian, so I reflect especially on my faith with that. And I think I just think that commercialism has kind of been winning out over some of those core family values.
Well, Dayton, thank you so much. Thanks for calling.
Let's go to another call. We've got Linda on the line in Eau Claire. Linda, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. See, I totally support the Mall of America and all stores that are closed on Thursday. I am a Black Friday shopper, but I think we need to draw the line. I think Thanksgiving is for families, and let the stores have as many early Black Fridays or other special shopping days, as many as they want, either before or after, but there's no need to be open on Thanksgiving.
And Linda, I got to ask, you're a Black Friday shopper. Are you an early morning Black Friday shopper?
I am, yes. We do get up at, 5 o'clock, 4 o'clock, and do the whole thing, but I mean, there's no need to go into Thursday, and I mean, that's just overboard.
Keep them separated. Linda, thank you so much for sharing that.
And we go next to Kathy, joining us in Greenfield. Kathy, hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Good, thanks. What do you think?
I was in retail for many years, and then I started my own company in 2010, Kathy's Second Chance Plants, and we have two part-timers, and they're going to spend their whole time with their family. We will not be open.
And what about Black Friday? What time do you open?
We open at our normal hours. We open at 10 o'clock in the morning, so that the employees that we do have, if they'd like to do any Black Friday shopping, they can get their stuff done before we open.
Nice. Kathy, thank you so much.
We are talking Thanksgiving Day shopping or lack of same. There's back and forth. Some stores want to be open. Some big players in the retail industry are drawing the line, saying, nope, we're going to hold off till Black Friday. Employees, spend time with the family. Shoppers, you too. Hearing what you think at 800-642-1234. Jim is with us next in Lake Geneva. Jim, hi.
Hi. Yeah. Every year I get together with my in-laws and their family, and after a big Thanksgiving meal on Thursday, we usually spend the night at their house and take off early Friday morning as a family and do the Black Friday shopping.
But
so we don't necessarily agree with the late Thursday night start. That's a little early, but Friday morning has kind of become a family tradition for us.
So you don't go out on Thanksgiving Day itself, but you're ready to rock on Friday morning?
Yeah.
With the family.
It's not unusual to be in line, 2 or 3 in the morning, Friday morning, with the whole family.
That's great, Jim. Thank you so much. Yeah, some people have definitely made a tradition of this. I was thinking, after that big Thanksgiving meal, the last thing I want to do is get out and wander around a mall for a while. I kind of just want to,
like lie there and be bloated with food.
That sounds delightful, Rob. I think the biggest hurdle for me is getting up. I'm never going to get up at 2:30 or even 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock. Otherwise, maybe. But yeah, those early hours are not for me. Let's go to Michael. Michael's next in Green Bay. Michael, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
I'm 46 years old, and I remember growing up, long before 24-hour stores and the way things are today. And I remember you had to get gasoline in your car the day before because there weren't gas stations open.
Oh,
there
yeah.
weren't convenience stores open. And I think it's about family values. And I think I carefully say this, that there should be laws mandating that on our holidays, there's a reason for holidays. And it's we need to get back to family values, our core values, and people shouldn't be working. I don't have to think companies should be putting workers in those positions unless it's an essential, something essential like a hospital or medical and ambulance services. You know, those type of things have to go around the clock every day. But I just wish we would start paying more attention to our holidays and finding and place more value into them. So,
Michael, thank you so much for that. Michael's saying there should be a law that these holidays have to be off across the board. Interesting take there. Thanks for that.
One more quick call with Josh in Portage. Josh, briefly, hi.
Hi. So I just wanted to say that I actually do like that some stores are open on Thanksgiving and some are closed, because it gives you the opportunity to shop at the ones that are open on Thanksgiving, and then you can go get the other deals on Friday morning.
All right, Josh, thanks a lot for that call. We got a pro open on Thanksgiving caller in there. I worked in a mall for a while, years ago, but it was in the days before they were open on Thanksgiving. It was never an issue.
Right, same here. Well, there's still options for both sides of this equation right now. People can stay in, go shopping with their families, and some stores are just staying closed. So we'll be tracking this one here on Central Time.
And everybody can share their thoughts still on the Central Time Facebook page. Coming up, we'll talk to the former mayor of Madison about the upcoming deer hunting season. He's a hunter. He sees some new regulations maybe taking away some of the camaraderie. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is the Ideas Network.
Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we look at how new regulations could affect hunting season in Wisconsin.
First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
There are many reasons to hunt. For Mike Paulus, part of the appeal is the quiet.
Things calm down right before dark, out in the woods. Yes, things are already pretty calm, but when you've been out in the woods all day, just sitting around, you tune in to the small but explosive chatter of animals the size of your fist, the clattering of dark tree branches and the creaking of their trunks as they sway against a blurry gray sky, the wind in the dead yellow grass. But the sun falls away and the quiet rolls in. Birds stop skittering their talons across the cold, brittle tree bark. The occasional thrum and rush from cars on a nearby county highway, it all fades out. The squirrels up and vanish. For me, there's a tension in all this calm. Like I'm sitting in a dim room, listening to my chest rise and fall, waiting for the door to bang open. So I plot out every little gesture before shifting my feet, before pushing my stocking cap back and forth to itch my scalp. I could bump something with my big boots, tip it over. I could knock the wall of my little plywood hut with my elbow, or my knee, or my gun. Just before dark, I expect the deer to come, picking their way through the gloomy tangle. Frustratingly slow for someone always eyeing up a flat glass screen, swiping past pictures and headlines and armchair commentary. I expect to see the deer before I hear them, pushing through, nose first, their heads bobbing low and wary, pausing. They always look so small. Their legs are so skinny, bones and fur and pointy hooves. They are like ghosts at this hour. You snatch glimpses and then there they are. My grandfather died during hunting season. Not while hunting. He was driving my grandma to Thanksgiving dinner. The heart attack waited until he had parked his pickup truck at a stop sign. 10 years have gone by, but just a few weeks ago, Grandma asked my mom if she had seen him. Grandma said she had spied him through a window earlier that day working outside. Where did he go? The last place my grandpa hunted was in a little shack in the woods behind my parents' house. Early in the morning after he died, my dad walked out there to sit in the dark. The sun rose up over the hill. The birds and the squirrels came out, and as always, the silence pulled away. I rarely see deer in the morning, but I still go out there each year and I wait. I wait all day. I sit there listening to the rustling and the scratching of all the tiny creatures, and I think the woods are a tremendous, magnificent mess. The wind rakes through the old dead leaves. From over the treetops, I can hear the humming of cars and trucks on a nearby county highway. And right before dark, things calm down.
Mike Paulus is the online editor for Volume 1 in Eau Claire. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
This weekend marks the opening of deer hunting season, gun deer hunting season in Wisconsin, and there are some recent changes in regulations that our next guest says may change the hunting experience.
In a recent article in Isthmus newspaper, former Madison Mayor Dave Cheslevich voiced his concern that regulation changes and smartphone technology could diminish the link between individual hunters and the broader hunting community. And we want to hear from you on this. Are you a hunter? What do you think about the new regulations? Will it change your hunting experience? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Dave Cheslevich joins us now. He's a hunter, former mayor of Madison, and incidentally but unrelated, executive director for the Wisconsin Bike Federation. Dave, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks. All three of those things are actually unrelated.
They're all true, I suppose. Yeah.
All true and unrelated. Right?
Well, now let's talk about some of these changes. This might be a little alien for people who aren't hunters. What has changed? This is a couple seasons in now.
Sure. So I think you've got to understand how the process has worked in the past. Mm-hmm. So for about 60 years, here's how it worked. If a hunter shot a deer, the hunter would be wearing a back tag to begin with. And I think most of us, even if we're not deer hunters, understand what that is. Came in different colors based on the year, and a hunter would literally wear it on the back of his coat. If a hunter shot a deer, the first thing he was required to do was go tag that deer. So he would remove the back tag. There would be a tear-off tag on the back tag that he would attach to the deer, and then that had to stay with the deer. And even if the hunter left the field, if a warden came by, he would know that that deer was legally taken. And the hunter would have to record the time of day, the day in which the deer was shot. And then within a certain period, about 24 hours after the deer was taken, the hunter was required to deliver the carcass to a registration station, physically deliver the deer to a registration station. And there were hundreds of these scattered around the state. And there'd be someone there to officially register the deer. It usually wasn't an official DNR person. Often, in my case, it was Sharon at the Natural Bridge store. In Rockbridge, Sharon owned the store, and she would come out, register the deer officially, remove the tag that I put on, and put on a more permanent metal tag attached to the deer. And then that metal tag actually had to follow the deer through the process. So even when the venison was snugly in my freezer at home, that metal tag had to remain with it. And the whole idea was that, look, deer and all wildlife don't belong to us as hunters, and they don't belong to landowners. They belong to all of us, the general public. And the way we take possession of that deer is to kill it legally during a hunting season, following all the regulations. And the whole point of all of these regulations was to assure that hunters, when they were taking public property for themselves, were doing it legally, following all the rules. And that was the reason for all of these things. Now, what's changed is, as of this year, you no longer have to have a back tag at all. And as of last year, and this continues this year, you don't actually physically have to deliver the deer to a registration station. And I understand why these changes are made. And I want to make it clear, I'm not criticizing Department of Natural Resources personnel. They work really hard. They're trying to make hunting easier. They're trying to get more people into hunting. What I'm raising is some broader concerns about what this says about how we view wildlife, because it seems to me that it's becoming more and more a private activity, something you do by yourselves or with a small group of friends, and that that obligation to the broader community is being lost in all this.
And also some of the camaraderie, you're right. When you went to the store to register, when you saw other hunters out with the same back tag as you, you were part of something bigger.
That's right. So typically what would happen is in the evening, hunters would show up, in my case, at the Natural Bridge store, and you'd have to get your deer certified, registered by Sharon, the store owner. And Sharon would usually employ a kid to come help her. And it took a while, right, because folks were there, a number of them. And, you know, you'd start a conversation with nice buck. And then, sure enough, deer hunters love to tell stories. And then they tell stories about how they came upon that that deer they had shot. And while you were there, very often you bought a bunch of stuff at Sharon's, half of which you probably didn't need. But it was a little stimulation for the local economy. And I think more importantly, it built this community of deer hunters. I think that was a really important part of the whole ritual. And now that's you can still do it if you want. I mean, I'll still go to Sharon's and because I want my deer tested for chronic wasting disease, but that's not required. And so a lot of the camaraderie that went with deer hunting is going out of it.
There are still some of these stations operating,
yes.
And you can go in and use their tablet or whatever to do this. A lot fewer of them, and the ones that are there, it sounds like a lot fewer people are going to.
Sure, absolutely. You could still do this if you want, but the DNR, to their credit, has created a very convenient system. I'm sitting here with my smartphone, and I'll be able to use this on Saturday or Sunday should I dispatch a deer. I can do it right in the field.
We're talking to former Madison mayor and hunter Dave Cheslevich about the recent changes in deer hunting regulations, how they impact our attitudes toward wildlife and the hunting experience as a whole. And you can join in at 800-642-1234.
That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
If you are going to be hunting this weekend, if you've noticed changes in the way that you register deer, if you think you'll be missing this camaraderie that you get when you go to register that deer, you don't have to do that in person anymore. Interested in hearing your thoughts. 800-642-1234. Pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're continuing our conversation with former Madison Mayor Dave Cheslevich about the latest changes in deer hunting regulations and how they may affect the more communal aspects of the hunting experience.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Will you be out there this weekend? What do you think about the changes? Registering from your phone instead of having to go to a station to do that, not having the tag on your back. Will you miss that? Feeling like something bigger, part of a hunting community. Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers. Ryan is with us first in River Falls. Ryan, hi. Ryan, are you there? Don't have Ryan. We'll try another Falls. We'll go to Bill with us in Sheboygan Falls. Bill, hi.
Hello. Hey, wonderful program. Thanks for this. Couple comments. I'm call myself a social deer hunter. I hunt with my brothers. I hunt with my son-in-law. I regret the loss of the back tag, which your guest can elaborate on the safety issues and the recognition of fellow hunters that way. But furthermore, then I regret the loss of the check-in station. I've recently become acquainted with a young man who we all want to encourage to start hunting. The check-in station was a wonderful place to get acquainted with the various deer that were brought in and their hunters, strike up a conversation, as your guest said. So I think these are, well, as your guest said, they're optional, but I would encourage deer hunters to keep up the tradition.
Bill, thanks a lot for the call and for sharing your thoughts. Dave, is there a way to keep this tradition even when people don't have to do it?
Well, sure. And as I said, in my deer camp in Richland County, the one I go to, the Jordahl camp, we'll continue to do it. And the reason we'll do it is because we want to have our deer tested for chronic wasting disease. And, of course, that's a show or several shows in and of itself. Sharon and at the Natural Bridge store still continues to do that. I think she's the only place that does it in Richland County. That's a problem in itself. I think that there should be more testing for CWD. So we will do that. But I think over time, as hunters realize they don't need to deliver their deer to a station, it is, frankly, easy to use your cell phone to register the deer. I think you're going to see a continuing drop-off. And I think that's unfortunate.
Bill, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go next to John in Racine. John, hi.
Hello. I was at the Fleet Farm store today, and they had this beautiful pink outerwear for deer hunters. I couldn't convince any of the guys to buy it.
Yeah? What do you think about this change in the system, John?
That was a joke.
Sorry. No, I gotcha. I gotcha. Sorry, I didn't laugh loud enough, but I was laughing.
Yeah. I think another example is the party permit. That used to be groups of people who are hunting. I can't remember, it was four or five. If the hunters could kill an extra deer, either sex, and it brought the group together. It was a reason to get together with family and friends for hunting and just a part of it. So I'm sorry to see that gone. I see the advantages. It was really nice to register my boat using the cell phone and it came in handy, but I miss some of these other things too. I don't think it's, and I think some of it is more of a privatization going on. There seems to be more and more emphasis on hunting on private land and not public. So it's hard to judge whether is it progress or is it just nostalgia.
John, thank you so much. A lot of interesting thoughts there, Dave.
Yeah, John brought up another really important point, which is sort of the emphasis on privatizing what has a really important public aspect to it. So purchases under the stewardship fund have dramatically been cut in recent years. There have been changes to the more managed forest law, so you can still get a tax break, but it's easier to close your land to hunting. I'm very lucky because 25 years ago I was invited to a hunting party on a private piece of land, so I'm not forced to public hunting grounds, but those are becoming more and more crowded. And again, I think it's part of an overall trend that makes us think about hunting more as a private activity. And we start to lose focus and lose that sense of the reality, which is that deer are a public resource. They're not owned by us.
Thanks a lot for the call, John, and good luck this weekend. We've got Daniel with us next in Cuba City. Daniel, hi.
Hi, yeah. I kind of miss actually going to buy a back tag and everything. My dad and I, we would sit there and we kind of make it a family thing of where we go down to a local store and get our back tags, and then we put them in together, and it became kind of a tradition. And then when we got deer, we go and we register it down at like a local registering station, and we share stories with other hunters about how they got their deer. And it made it nice for like young hunters and everything to go show what they got and show some pride.
Daniel, did you keep those tags from year to year?
I actually did. It was kind of nice to actually be able to sit back and go, I've hunted with my family for this many years.
Thank you so much for sharing your story, Daniel.
Yeah, you're starting to get a sense with these calls. Deer hunting is like a sacrament in Wisconsin. There's sheepshead, there's brandy old fashions, there's deer hunting. And this stuff goes pretty deep. And it's not just about harvesting the deer. Probably two out of 3 years, I never pull the trigger. And still, I love deer hunting. I love all of the rituals about it. This stuff goes back a long way, and it goes really deep.
Thanks a lot for the call. We're talking to Dave Cheslevich, a hunter, former mayor of Madison. He recently wrote a piece on how changes, upgrades in some ways, and how hunters register their deer are taking away some of the communal spirit, some of the connection to wildlife involved in hunting in Wisconsin. Back to your calls. John is with us now in Madison. John, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What do you think?
Well, first, some things I really like about the new rules and some things that concern me. I'm a bow hunter, and I do a lot of bow hunting every single weekend from the time the season opens till it closes, till they kick me out, essentially. I hunt with traditional gear and regular gear, and the name of the game for me is get very close and be as quiet, blend into the woods as much as possible. And that back tag on my tag has always been cumbersome, and it rustles against the bark. It gets tangled up in my back or my tree stand when I'm carrying it in. It's always been in my way and an annoyance, quite honestly. I'm really enjoying this year not having that thing on my back. But the reason that the DNR registers deer is to keep track of the number of harvested deer. And that's the only way that they really have any means of keeping track of the population and where it's at, how many deer we should take. Now that you don't have to do that and you can just call in on your phone, I'm concerned about people just maybe dragging their feet on registering and then just not registering, or there really isn't anything to keep you from taking more animals than you're supposed to. You used to have your deer visible until it was registered at the registration station. That's no longer a rule. So you can kind of go under the radar, I think, now. And I'm concerned that it's going to make it hard for the DNR to really keep track of the numbers.
And John, thanks. I want to get Dave in on this. And Dave, you write that this is a worry for you, poaching.
It is. And, you know, you hope you're wrong about that. But certainly all of these things made it more difficult to not follow the rules. And we've had a series of changes now over several years, which frankly make it a little bit easier. If you're most hunters, vast majority of hunters are honest folks and they'll do the right thing. But if you're predisposed to this kind of thing, it makes it easier to poach. That's absolutely right.
Thanks, John. Time for one more call. Mike is with us in Bruce. Mike, hi.
Hi. You know, I think I agree with most of the ideas that the guest is bringing up. I do like the convenience of the call-in stuff, but what I'm really more concerned about is similar to what the theme he started in discussing. I want to take a little further, which is on the antlerless tags. It's the first hard example of the result of having this deer czar come in and the privatization of the resource, and that you no longer can just apply for an antlerless permit. You have to make a decision on, is that going to be a private land antlerless permit, or is that going to be a public land antlerless permit?
And Mike, I want to, just a minute left, Dave.
Well, it might get a little esoteric for people who aren't hunters, but this is a really important point that Mike's making. This is the first year that I'm aware of where you get tags for deer that you might harvest, and this is the first year I'm aware of where the DNR has made a distinction between harvesting on public and private land. And again, I think it moves us into this direction of pushing deer hunting more and more into a private kind of thing. And hunters get into a private state of mind. They start thinking not only is the land private, but the deer are also private, belonging to us, and that's really dangerous.
We'll leave it there, Dave. Thanks a lot for joining
us. Thanks for having
me. Dave Cheslevich is a hunter, former mayor of Madison. We've been talking about changes in deer hunting in Wisconsin. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time.